partly sunny this afternoon. Cloudy tonight, lows in the 30s. Currently, it's sunny and 47 degrees. Stay tuned for Shaynana with Zain Al-Amin. I'm Askia Muhammad. Thank you for listening to WPFW Washington.
You're listening to Shaynana, your source for music, mint, and tea. Wednesdays from 2 to 3 on WPFW 89.3 or online at wpfw.org.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is your host, Zain Al-Amin, for the program Shaynana. Before we start today with our lineup of great guests, I just wanted to make a pitch for fundraising for WPFW. This is the beginning of our fund drive, and we cannot do this what we're doing today and having these great guests and having all this amazing information and filling a niche on the radio, on live radio, that is not being filled right now in terms of FM radio here in the capital. One of the things that you can do, you can call 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739 and make a donation. You can also be a sustainer. Consider a gift of $120 where you pay $10 a month. Our goal for this show is 4 members and $500, a very modest goal. So I know you've been listening. I know you love the station. I know you love the new programming, not just here on Shaynana, but the programming as a whole. I've been hearing great feedback. And as you know, we've had musicians, we've had writers, we had people comment on all sorts of aspects critical issues that have affected the Middle East. And we've been there for you during the recent issues relating to Islamophobia and France and in terms of the Gaza Strip when the invasion happened. And also in terms of clarifying politics in difficult countries like Lebanon. So please, again, call 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. It's my pleasure to introduce our guest who's visiting town here, May Al-Nakib. And a little bit about Nakib. She's the author of a collection of short stories, The Hidden Light of Objects, which was published by Bloomsbury in 2014. The collection won the Edinburgh International Book Festival's 2014 First Book Award. Her short stories have appeared in Ninth Letter and The First Line. She holds a PhD in English literature from Brown University and teaches postcolonial studies and comparative literature at Kuwait University. She is currently writing her first novel. Welcome, May.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you're in town to do a couple of readings, right, May?
Yeah, that's right. The Hidden Light of Objects was recently released in the U.S., and so I'm spending the month of February going around. My first stop is D.C., and tonight I'm doing a reading at Georgetown, and tomorrow at SAIS, Johns Hopkins, and then on Thursday at the World Bank.
Excellent. Since this is a pre-recorded show, listeners will probably miss tonight's show because tonight is Tuesday, but there will be a reading on Wednesday and Thursday, right?
That's right. Wednesday at 12:30 to 2 at SAIS Johns Hopkins, and then Thursday from 12:30 to 2 at the World Bank.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So tell us a bit about the Hidden Light of Objects.
So it's a collection of loosely connected short stories that are set mainly in the Middle East. So there's stories set in Kuwait, in Lebanon, in Palestine, but also outside the Middle East too. And the stories attempt to trace quiet, overlooked moments in the region, in a region that's often overwhelmed by geopolitics. And although the stories engage events that are familiar to people, for example, the invasion of Kuwait or the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or the civil war in Lebanon, the focus isn't really on those events, but more on the everyday lives of people who live there. And so the stories I mentioned are connected. They're loosely connected through character, through tone, through theme, and through a series of objects, which is why it's called The Hidden Light of Objects. So they all hinge in one way or another on a chance material object that unleashes a memory or a sensation, and then they kind of try to engage or to consider what remembering that feeling might allow to happen.
Excellent. So you have several stories that are one where you have a middle-aged man dying from cancer who looks back at his extramarital affairs and the abiding forgiveness of his wife. You have a story about a Kuwaiti woman that returns to her family after being held captive in Iraq for a decade. Another one about a self-conscious Palestinian teenager that is drawn to a botched suicide bombing by two belligerent classmates, and other such stories, which are all intriguing. In terms of your background, May, where were you born and raised?
Well, I was born in Kuwait, but was just a few months old when my parents moved to the UK and then to the US, to St. Louis, Missouri. And we didn't return back to Kuwait until I was six. So my first language was actually English rather than Arabic. And we moved back to Kuwait. I went to the American school in Kuwait and grew up in Kuwait and would spend a lot of time in the U.S., about 3 months out of the year in the U.S., but grew up mainly in Kuwait.
Did you ever, when you were growing up in Kuwait, did you ever learn the Arabic language?
I did. I learned it, of course, you know, living in the country itself, but also in school we also learned Arabic. But I very much learned it as a second language.
I see.
Which is a kind of interesting experience, being in the country where the first language is Arabic, but in fact learning the language as a second language. It's been an interesting situation.
I'm a writer myself, and sometimes I struggle when writing stories in how to basically include the Arabic language, like in terms of characters that are there. You know, it's a thing that's much discussed among poets and writers from the Middle East, and even, you know, especially Juno Diaz, famously commented about that once. I think you know what I'm talking about. Is like, how much of the language should you include? Should you, are there certain expressions or curses or anything that you should write in Arabic? Should you explain them? Should you put that in parentheses, etc.? Do you ever have that struggle with what you write?
I do. It hasn't really felt like a struggle. I feel like the experience of doing that, which I did include, I mean, you can't not do that, I think, as a writer writing about a particular place. These elements, especially again, if you're kind of in between, you're navigating between languages, this is going to happen. But I found it to be actually a really interesting experience, because even as you kind of use words that may be unfamiliar to a non-Arabic speaking audience, and that word gets highlighted, whether because you're not translating it, you're just throwing it into the text, and it's unfamiliar to a reader, I feel like that unfamiliarity can open up an experience of a place that's unfamiliar, and I think that that can be very productive. At the same time, let's say a native Arabic speaker is picking up the same book, and you think, okay, well, they don't need to be, the word doesn't need to be explained to them. But even they, in the context of having this word in an English text, re-engage or re-experience this word from a different perspective. I mean, that is something that I thought about, and I think that it's a kind of two-way street. Both sets of readers experience the language that's kind of being reinvented by these writers in new ways, and I find that really productive and interesting rather than something to worry about.
Well, that's very enlightening. It's always helpful to hear about different people's experience with that.
Yeah.
So, Mike, can you tell us one more time about the two events that are coming up on Wednesday and Thursday in terms of your readings?
Sure. So Wednesday, that's tomorrow, the 4th of February, from 12:30 to 2, I'll be giving a talk at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins. And then on Thursday, the 5th of February, also from 12:30 to 2, I'll be giving a talk and reading at the World Bank, which is at the J1050 building. And I'll be, you know, I'll be talking a little bit about the hidden light of objects, but also the experience of living and writing in the Middle East, the you know, cosmopolitanism in Kuwait, and also the question of language. As well as giving a reading from the book itself. So all of these things will be part of the event.
Excellent. Well, I'm sure I'll see you at one of those events.
I look forward to meeting you.
Take care. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Zane. Thank you.
Take care. So it is my pleasure to start with Maha Hilal, who will be talking about Islamophobia. Just a short intro of Maha. She's the Deputy Executive Director of the National Coalition to Protect Civil Freedoms, which is an organization dedicated to addressing civil and human rights abuses related to preemptive prosecutions and thoughts crime in the war on terror. Maha earned her doctorate last May from the Department of Justice, Law and Society at American University in Washington, D.C., the title of her dissertation, a title which I like, Too Damn Muslim to Be Trusted, The War on Terror and the Muslim-American Response. She received her master's degree in counseling and her bachelor's degree in sociology from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She worked at a number of human rights and social justice organizations, including the Center for Victims of Torture, the National Religious Campaign Against Torture, and the Government Accountability Project. Maha was previously a Christine Mirzayan Fellow at the National Academy of Sciences, as well as a recipient of the Department of State's Critical Language Scholarship for Arabic Study in Morocco. Welcome, Maha.
Thank you, Zane.
How are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Good. I'm doing great. So today we're going to talk with you about this continuing issue that existed since 9/11 in a more visible way, and before 9/11 in a maybe a less visible way. But there is consistencies between Islamophobia pre-9/11 and post-9/11. But most another turning point that we've had recently, or another point of discussion, is obviously what went on in France recently. Earlier you and I had a little chat, and we talked about the issue of white privilege and collective responsibility. Would you like to talk a little bit about that, expand on that in layman's terms for the listeners?
Sure, and maybe it would be helpful to just give a brief overview of the research I have done with respect to this topic.
That'll be wonderful.
Okay. So, as you mentioned, the title of my dissertation was Too Damn Muslim Trusted, the One and the Muslim American Response. And my dissertation aimed to really study the impacts of the post 9/11 counterterrorism policies on the Muslim American population. Part of doing this analysis was interviewing Muslim Americans and surveying Muslim Americans to get their attitudes about have they felt that they've been targeted, what were the impacts of these policies, did they know anyone who was impacted, how had this affected their ideas and perceptions of citizenship, and things of that nature. But one of the most important things, I think, in doing this research was my use of a particular framework called the Social Construction and Policy Design Framework. And the reason I think that this is so important is because this framework pushes for the study of social constructions that are embedded in policy design and implementation. And this is important, in my opinion, because of the way a lot of these policies have been designed to incorporate specific negative social constructions of Muslims. And then on the implementation side, you see that a lot of policies have actually, as a matter of fact, even if they're general in nature in terms of the language that's used, that when it comes down to it, they're actually directly impacting and targeting Muslims and Muslim Americans. And so I think it's really important to consider the ways in which these negative social constructions are operating not only in society, but also in the policy realm. Another important point, I think, with regards to that is the fact that a lot of these policies, when implemented and targeted towards Muslims, give the broader society sort of the okay to subsequently target the same group of people. Because if the government is serving as a model as to who it's okay to target and treat differently, then the society subsequently gets that same message that it's okay to treat these people poorly, that they're terrorists, they're this monolithic homogenous group of individuals who are inherently violent, etc. So that's kind of an overview of the way, what my study was focused on and the approach that I took. That said, you know, a lot of the findings I discovered were things such as that Muslim Americans felt largely targeted by the war on terror policies. This is not necessarily a profound finding, but it's important to know and to have empirical data that tells us this. In addition, a lot of the Muslim Americans in my study also reported, you know, feeling diminished legal and cultural citizenship, which is also important in terms of our understanding of what it takes to be a democracy. Democracy necessarily involves participation from all of its citizens. So can we really say we have a democracy if we're implementing a series of policies that marginalize a particular group of individuals? So I will stop right there in case you have any questions on that, and then maybe go on to the initial question you asked me.
Yes, I would like to know more about the initial question that that we started on before the show started, yes.
Sure. So in my research as well, this idea of collective responsibility surfaced. So the idea of collective responsibility, of course, is just this idea that a single individual or a group of individuals commit acts of violence, right? That individuals who share an identity with the perpetrator are then held responsible for that act of violence. 9/11, we have seen this happen to the Muslim and Muslim American communities repeatedly. So whenever there is an act of violence that's perpetrated by a Muslim, even regardless of whether or not they actually use Islam as a rationale for their attacks, the whole Muslim community is held collectively responsible. They're expected to offer some sort of condemnation, condolences, etc. I think the other side is to point out the fact that this is something only expected of Muslims and Muslim Americans. So in other words, with perpetrators, for example, that are right-wing white Christians commit acts of violence, there's absolutely no outcry about the violence that's been committed, and there are no calls whatsoever for individuals to take responsibility just because of their shared identity with the perpetrator. So what the 9/11 atmosphere has overwhelmingly shown in this regard is that, you know, there's a double standard. There's a double standard in terms of who is expected to respond to what and how. And a couple of weeks ago, I partook in a discussion along the lines of white privilege specifically and collective responsibility. So when we, you know, try to deal with this topic, there are important couple of things, you know, to mention here. One is that the example I just gave, or the that I just gave in terms of who is expected to take responsibility. These patients over and over again have shown that white do have privilege in that they are not both responsible, nor do they expect them to actually respond to any of these acts of violence. So I think that's, you know, a very important part of the discussion. And another part of the discussion is that when I was speaking again earlier, we talked about white privilege as something sort of pertaining to the past. In other words, white people atoning for past sins. Whereas in this context, and numerous other contexts, white privilege is something that's institutional. It's very much at play in the context in which we exist today. So this means that, you know, anyone who is white has privileges given to them by virtue of their skin color. Now, in the context that we're talking about here, this means that they are not seen as a homogenous collective entity that, you know, any single individual represents or needs to apologize for the acts of others, et cetera. So I think it's important to understand this in terms of who's held responsible for what, who has the privilege of not bearing responsibility, and I think, generally speaking, who the society privileges, who the society upholds, and who the society ultimately has negative social constructions of that leads to repercussions in this way for example, for Muslims and Muslim Americans.
One thing is that in terms of, as an activist that I've encountered, you know, on the one hand, there is the problems that you brought up in terms of collective responsibility and in terms of the privileges that exist, whether white folks are aware of them or not. There's also the issue of sometimes there's a paralyzing effect among our allies, our white allies, whether it's in terms of supporting Muslims or supporting people of color in the United States in general. There is a kind of I've been in planning meetings where everybody agrees on an issue and is in a room trying to plan, and suddenly the issue of white privilege is brought up, and we have white liberals self-flagellating themselves, and then we have people of color attacking them, and then that devolves into a non-productive session, to say the least. So it's one thing that I've always been very concerned about.
To respond to your first statement regarding the question of whether or not, you know, white people are always necessarily aware of acts of violence that are perpetrated by other white people, it may, in fact, be the case that they're not aware, but the fact that they're not aware is also an extremely problematic double standard, because when a Muslim commits an act of violence, I don't think there's a single Muslim who's not aware. Yeah. At least any Muslim who has access to, you know, basic forms of communication, whether it's internet, radio, TV, etc. So that in and of itself is a privilege to not know. Because again, there's not a single Muslim in the United States, for example. If we were to compare Muslims in the United States to whites in the United States, Muslims as a whole, I would expect about 95% of Muslims to know that if there was an attack perpetrated by a Muslim, they would know that there had been an attack perpetrated by a Muslim. They would not be able to avoid that information. This is not only because they might be more attuned to the issue, but also because the media would disproportionately report on this issue. Government officials would be more likely to comment on the issue. People would probably be more likely to post on this issue on various avenues of social media. So to me, even if you can claim some sort of ignorance, you still have to acknowledge the reason why that ignorance might come into play. In regards to your second point, I think, you know, it's an interesting point in terms of, and this is always a struggle when you're bringing various groups together, in terms of, you know, what it means to be an ally or what it means to work in solidarity with different groups, particularly if you're not of that group. And I'm not sure I have the solution to that, but I think in large part it involves prioritizing the viewpoints of those who are directly affected. And so I think that, you know, if there are these meetings that are taking place, you know, for those individuals who are not Muslim, for example, to really listen to what these individuals are saying, to really listen to the hardships they're facing, to empathize, to validate. I think one example of this that I have found kind of problematic and perhaps slightly different, but there was this World Hijab Day that happened maybe a week or so ago. And on the face of it, I thought, you know, it's a good idea to get people to understand the experiences of Muslim women who wear hijab. But on the other hand, it also has this minimizing element, which is to say that if these people did not directly experience it, doesn't mean it's not happening, that these women are not experiencing the negative consequences of their reporting to have experience. No, it doesn't. So I think it's also about figuring out the best way to approach different situations and create a ripe atmosphere for empathy and solidarity.
One thing about, in terms of going back to the other point of building a narrative from before 9/11, I see a lot of things that are that have happened recently, that happened before 9/11, but are not people are talking about them as their new developments, as a, mm-hmm. as a new kind of racism, as a post 9/11 thing. But take for example, in terms of what happened in France. Immediately, within 2 days, obviously, there were many attacks on Muslims. Among them was a Muslim woman that was walking in the market, was attacked by two French men, and they threw her to the ground. They were beating her when she told them that she is pregnant. And when she told them that she was pregnant, one of the men actually kicked her in the stomach, which eventually resulted in the aborting of the child. And that reminded me the moment in before 9/11. In fact, there was a cosmic coincidence on the morning of 9/11, where I was sitting having breakfast with a friend, telling her about Oklahoma City bombing, which happened way before 9/11 under Clinton. And I told her how an Iraqi woman was sitting in her house after the Oklahoma City bombing, which was obviously, we found out later, it was a white, quote-unquote Christian militiaman that did it. Mm-hmm. I was telling her how the brunt of the reaction was against Muslims, because mm-hmm. the news reports were that Middle Eastern men, swarthy-looking men, were seen leaving the scene, as if anybody actually runs towards a bombing after it happens. And mm-hmm. and so they, what happened is this Iraqi woman, also a pregnant woman, that was sitting in her living room, and a brick was thrown through her window, and in making an attempt to jump out of the way, she fell face first on the floor, also resulting in an abortion too, in an aborted mm-hmm. child. And I saw those parallels, and I just wanted to tell, you know, people and tell listeners that this is very consistent with what was happening before 9/11. And that brings us to today, where there's another layer, or seems to be another layer, where there's some, you know, these kooky right wingers that believe in various regions of the United States, that believe there's some sort of a threat of a Muslim takeover now. So I just wanted to see what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, for sure. You know, it is interesting the point you raise in terms of the degree to which people are aware of this pre-9/11 type Islamophobia. I don't know that there's a way to really study it empirically in terms of is it worse, better now, but presumably it's much worse now mm-hmm. because of the way that, you know, the 9/11 attack went down and sort of the rhetoric and narrative that has sort of accompany that. I think, in general, from the research I did as well, you know, numerous scholars, such as Louise Taker and others, you know, have pointed to the fact that the policies that were implemented post 9/11 could not have been implemented in such rapid speed, with such egregious consequences, had it not been for the pre 9/11 Islamophobia. So, a lot of the policies, in other words, the severity of the policies in terms of consequences, were a direct result of the pre 9/11 Islamophobia that helped lay the groundwork for what happened thereafter. I think that that is definitely a very important point to consider when we're thinking about the evolution of Islamophobia and how far back we have to go in order to understand the buildup of these negative social constructions that have persisted for decades. I very much agree with you in terms of that. And I think it's another interesting point with respect to the backlash that you talked about is that, you know, this pretty much happens at this point every time there's an act of terror committed by Muslims. There is always inevitably some sort of backlash. The Muslim community and whatever community it has to endure. And again, that is also a function of Islamophobia that continues to persist and maintains itself because of, you know, basically, you know, every time there's an attack, it basically justifies the narrative of people that want to perpetuate this Islamophobia. And then it's consistently and constantly building on it. So it's really hard to, you know, dismantle it when there's a, you know, simultaneous narratives of collective responsibility, Muslims are bad, they're violent, etc., and then another act of violence happens. Of course, you know, those of us who are the majority of the Muslim community who have no, you know, control over this, who are not privy to any of the details, who have absolutely nothing to do with this, are put in a very difficult position. But I think in terms of, you know, the ways that we understand how to dismantle Islamophobia becomes then very complex and nuanced and honestly very challenging. Because of the way that it continues to persist and the ways in which this idea of collective responsibility is not challenged every time that there is an act of terror that's committed by Muslims. Instead of it being, we should challenge this idea that Muslims are a monolithic homogenous entity, it's like, oh look, they did it again. They are responsible, they are bad people, and we should target them.
Thank you very much, Maha. This was very enlightening. I'm sure we'll have you at some other occasion, unfortunately, because those occasions keep on popping up where there's attacks on Muslims across the country. Good luck with finishing your dissertation.
I'm done.
You're done. Fantastic.
Yeah.
When did you complete it?
Last May?
Oh, okay. Will it be published as a book or?
It's published as a dissertation, so I can most definitely send you a link for that. And hopefully in the future, a book.
Excellent. And we'll post it. We have a Facebook page, Shayo Nana. It's S-H-A-Y. W-A-N-A-N-A. S-H-A-Y, one word. W-A, another word. Nana, N-A-N-A, another word.
Okay, perfect.
For the listeners, so we'll post it on there. And I urge listeners to like us on Facebook, too, and to check out Maha's dissertation. Thank you so much, Maha.
I can hear the recording tomorrow?
Yes, tomorrow. Our show airs every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m.
Okay, perfect.
Take care, Maha.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Uhuru means freedom. My name is M1. I'm half of the legendary Tell It Like It Is, Everything Is Political, Bulletproof, hip-hop duo Dead Prez. Democracy and improvisation are essential components of hip-hop, as they are of jazz. I urge you to support 89.3 FM, your station for jazz and justice, by visiting WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org to pledge your support.
At WPFW, we embrace the South African expression Ubuntu, which means we are because you are. Our community radio station has been your source for independent voices, outstanding music, and alternative news for more than three decades. We have the ability to provide this unique blend of jazz and justice because of the generosity of our listener supporters. Ubuntu evokes the reality that we are all connected as a human family and need each other to be successful. We invite you to join us in our winter membership campaign starting Monday, February 2nd, as we present special programming focusing on jazz, health and wellness, peace and social justice, rhythm and blues, and more. Every contribution counts towards strengthening the bond we have with you and keeping 89.3 FM strong. Won't you partner with us? Pledge early and often by visiting us online at wpfw.org. Thank you.
نحن والقمر جيران بيته خلف تلالنا بيطلع من قبالنا يسمع الألحان نحن والقمر جيران عارفين وعيدنا وتارك بأرميدنا أجمل الألوان ياما سهرنا معه في ليل الهنا مع النهدى وياما على مطلعه شرحنا الهوى غوى حكايات نحن والقمر جيران لما طلوا زارنا عقنات رضا رشرش المرجان
يا جارة القمر يا أحلى غنيك يا جارة القمر موجب هالسهريك ناني وذكر حب وسمر ليل الهوى سهرتك يا جارة القمر نحن والقمر جيران
جيران
نحن والقمر جيران
جيران
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Shayan Nana with your host, Zain Al-Amin. We've been bringing you all sorts of artists and commentators on all things political all over the Middle East. We've been bringing you the heavy, the tea, and the light, the na'na, which is the mint. And we've been really mixing it up and presenting you with the bouquet of news and cultural events and insights into controversial issues that are being discussed. We've been providing you with a niche information that's not found on FM radio today. This is part of the excellent brand new WPFW programming that has been implemented for at least the past year. So This is a time of fun drive, and this is the time for survival for us. So we urge you to call and make a pledge. You can call 202-588-9739, or you can call 1-800-222-9739, or you can also visit us online and make a pledge online at WPFW.org. As you know, all of our shows are archived, and you can download them and listen to them as podcasts. And you can listen to the shows live on WPFW.org. Our goal for this show is a modest $500, and we need just four people. That's our goal, four members as a goal for this show. Again, call 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. Our next guest today will be Rama Khudaimi, who is the membership and outreach coordinator for the U.S. Campaign to End Occupation. And we'll be talking with Rama specifically about the Muslim Leadership Initiative, an initiative that's been controversial because of its the stated intent, and the real intent has been in contradiction. To give you a little bit of information about Rama, Rama has worked at several grassroots activist organizations, including Code Pink, the Washington Peace Center, and the Arab American Action Network. She has a Master's of Arts degree in conflict resolution from Georgetown University and bachelor's in journalism from Northwestern University. Her writing has been published by Al Jazeera English, The Progressive, Truth Out, and more. Welcome, Rama.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. If you can, we can start by learning more about what is this, the stated purpose of this Muslim Leadership Initiative, and who started this initiative?
So, the initiative first came to light in the summer of 2014 when we saw that there were certain participants of the Muslim Leadership Initiative, MLI, publishing articles about their recent trip to Israel and how they came back with a new understanding of Judaism, Israel, and Zionism. And for folks the Shalom Hartman Institute, where this MLI initiative is housed, this is precisely the point of this program, is to make Muslim Americans have a new viewpoint towards Israel, Zionism, and Judaism. And very clearly, just from that stated intent, there's a lot of problems, and that there seems to be a very weird conflation between Judaism, Zionism, and Israeli state policy, something that Palestine activists have been fighting against for so long, making it very clear that there's nothing, that Zionism and Israeli state policy is very separate from Judaism, and that criticizing Israel and criticizing Zionism and the horrible effect Israel has had on Palestinians, it's not anti-Semitic in any way. And so this has been the MLI stated intent to change that. There's also been a lot of talk by MLI participants that, no, this has nothing to do with Palestine, this has nothing to do with Israel, this is really an interfaith trip meant to build bridges between Muslims and Jews in the U.S., which is interesting, considering that they would travel all the way to Israel to do that. If that is the actual purpose, is interfaith relations between Muslim and Jewish Americans, then why is the program not focused on building those relationships here in the U.S.?
The one thing is like the most obvious things that come to mind, as more Jewish Americans are supportive of Palestinian liberation, of ending the occupation, is that there's an obvious, you don't have to go to Israel and meet the quote-unquote other side in order to build solidarity between Jews and Muslims. The most obvious we should mention that Jewish Voices for Peace, since the position that it's taken on the Gaza invasion that happened recently, has tripled in size, and the Jewish Voices for Peace is one of the organizations that is building a lot of solidarity between, a lot of goodwill between the two religions, Jewish and Muslim. And recently they had released a statement that says the ILM says it brings Muslim American leaders to Israel in order to focus on the relations between American Muslims and American Jews. These relations would be best forged here in the United States and rooted in our communities. To that end, Jewish Voices for Peace invites MLI participants to meet with us instead of going on a one-sided trip abroad, in order to share our common commitment to ending racism, anti-Jewish, anti-Muslim, and anti-Arab bigotry and all forms of oppression. Can you comment more about that?
I think one of the biggest pushbacks against this MLI trip is also this idea that the trip engages in what Sana Saeed, who's been doing a lot of work on covering the trip, has called faith washing, pretending and putting forth this argument that what's happening in Palestine is a conflict between Muslims and Jews, which is completely false for anyone who knows the history of what's going on. This is an issue of the settler colonialism. This is an issue of Palestinians, indigenous population fighting back against the settler colonialism, and it's not some ancient hatred between Muslims and Jews that's playing out, which when Muslims make it seem that, when MLI makes it seem that all Muslims and Jews need to just talk and to bring about peace, that's what it's lending, this ideology that this is just Muslims and Jews fighting. It's also very problematic because it assumes that every Palestinian is a Muslim and forgets that there's significant population of Palestinian Christians who also suffer from Israeli occupation, Israeli apartheid, Israeli ethnic cleansing, that there are non-Muslim, non-Christian Palestinians that also suffer from Israeli crimes. So I think we need to really push back against this attempt to paint it as a Muslim-Jewish thing, because that just makes it much more complicated than it actually is. It's an issue of Israel, a settler colonial state, that has been ethnically cleansing Palestinians for several decades now.
Yes, and that becomes such a farce, this kind of initiative, when there's so many opportunities here at home that are growing right now in the United States and in the world at large. One of the things about the issue of dialogue, I've witnessed here in the years of activism in Washington, D.C., where organizations have created venues for dialogue that continued for years, only to fall apart at the first crisis, at the site of a first crisis, because the dialogue wasn't built on anything solid. But another a great example of real collaboration between Jewish and Muslim activists is Combatants for Peace. And I don't know if you've ever come across them, but I was contacted once some Jewish activists from Combatants for Peace to organize an event. And when I talked with them, it was Jewish and Palestinian, actually Israeli Jews and Palestinians, that were coming to talk. They wanted to talk to university students and such, and have these events. And I told them, why do you think you're so successful? Why do you stick together? Why are you effective in kind of presenting this kind of very controversial idea. Back then in the United States, it was more controversial than it is now, and having a real dialogue. And basically, they told me that the dialogue was not based on, like, let's hold hands and sing Kumbaya. It was based on the fact that one party admits that they're an occupier, and then another party says we're the occupied, and the one party that's guilty of the occupation works towards ending the occupation. And they said that was the basis for our dialogue.
So definitely, and that's another that brings up two other issues with the Muslim Leadership Initiative. So a lot of people have been saying, why are you all against dialogue? And it's not that we are against dialogue. There's a lot that can come from people coming together and speaking. But MLI is a clear example of normalization. There is no clear understanding that there is an occupied and an occupier, that there is an oppressed and an oppressor. They look at the conflict as a conflict between two equal sides, which is completely false and a very clear example of normalization. And so we cannot accept that narrative because it's a false narrative and, again, does not show what's actually happening, the fact that Israel is the aggressor and it's the Palestinians who are struggling for their freedom and justice and equality. MLI also very clearly crosses boycott, divestment, sanctions, BDS, the BDS line. The Shalom Hartman Institute, where, again, the program is housed, has a lot of relationships with the Israeli Defense Force, the IDF, including training IDF soldiers in ethics. And so that clearly makes it a boycottable institution, and thus any programs from it, like MLI, boycottable.
Before we end the segment, I wanted to ask you about the U.S. campaign to end the occupation, recent involvement in the Skip the Speech campaign. How's that going? Do you have any information on that?
Yeah, so...
If you can tell the audience what that is and what's happening.
So where I work, the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation is a coalition of 400 groups across the country working to end all U.S. aid for Israeli occupation and apartheid. We work on several different levels. One is changing U.S. policies that help entrench Israel's occupation and apartheid. Ranges from mostly from the $3 billion in military aid that we provide every single year to Israel, so U.S. weapons that help Israel continue its occupation, as well as diplomatic support. So, for example, using our veto power at the U.N. to protect Israel. We also do a lot of work around, like I said, BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaigns, which are aimed at companies and institutions that are complicit in Israel's war crimes. And if folks want to learn to get involved, you can definitely visit our website, endtheoccupation.org.
That is endtheoccupation.org. Check it out. Thank you so much, May.
Thank you.
Say hello to Josh Rubner for me.
I definitely will. Thank you.
Take care.
The D.C. area's annual Midwinter Jazz Classic, the Mid-Atlantic Jazz Festival, is just around the corner, the weekend of February 13th to the 16th. Join media sponsor WPFW for NEA Jazz Masters Kenny Barron and Ellis Marcellus, the masterful vocal artistry of Carmen Lundy, Alan Harris, Tierney Sutton, and DC's favorites Sharon Clark and Janine Gilbert Carter, plus three of today's saxophone titans doing royal battle in our saxophone summit. Featured also will be DC's finest artist, free student performances, and meet the artist opportunities, and much, much more. That's the Mid-Atlantic Jazz Festival, the annual jazz family reunion, February 13th to the 16th, at beautiful Hilton Hotel in Rockville, Maryland, conveniently located on Rockville Pike, right on the Red Line Twin Brook Metro. Visit www.midatlanticjazzfestival.org for complete details or call area code 888-909-6330.
This is WPFW News. I'm Askia Muhammad. Here are some headlines at the 3 o'clock hour. Walmart's request for a special zoning exception to build a new supercenter at Crane Highway and Mill Branch Road was denied recently. Congratulations to our community allies in Bowie for standing up to Walmart and preserving their community and good jobs in Prince George's County, said United Food and Commercial Workers Local 400. In other Walmart news, quote, "If it was up to me, I'd put that rope around your neck." That's what Walmart manager Art Van Ripper told employee Markeith Washington in September 2012. But even after such threatening remarks, Van Ripper is still employed by Walmart. That's even after a federal administrative law judge found in December that Walmart illegally disciplined workers who went on strike because of his racist and violent threats. Markeith, his co-workers, and members of Our Walmart Civil Rights have launched a petition on Color of Change calling on Walmart to terminate Van Ripper, rehire the associates who protested the incident, and put human resources practices in place to ensure racist threats of violence never again happen in a store. In just a few days, it has more than 40,600 signatures. Hockey fans in Rapid City, South Dakota, poured beer on a group of Native American children and shouted racial slurs at them during a hockey game, television station KOTA reported Monday. The 57 children who attended the Rush hockey game on Saturday were students at the American Horse School and were invited to the game as part of a program with the hockey team. Saturday's incident got so out of control that chaperones removed the students from the arena. One of the chaperones and parents, Justin Poorbear, wrote about the event on Sunday in a Facebook post, quote, "They were getting drunk, and around the third quarter, they were talking stuff to our kids and throwing down beer on some of them, including our staff and students, telling our students to go back to the res," as in reservation. Poorbear wrote, Poorbear said he was upset and was invited to fight about it by the fans hurling beer from the VIP section. D.C. Public Schools admitted that private information for special education students was exposed to the public. The breach existed for years until it was discovered by BuzzFeed reporters who confronted DCPS officials with the information on Monday. BuzzFeed reports that hundreds of pages of documents with sensitive and confidential information about special education students, teachers, and some other school workers sat unprotected for years. In a statement, DCPS said the database was housed on an internal website that was launched in 2010. As soon as it learned of the problem, the school district shut down the site. DCPS also says there is currently no evidence the data was compromised. A New York City police officer has been indicted for assault after he was caught on video stomping on the head of an unarmed African American who was pinned to the ground and pleading for help. The incident took place in Brooklyn July 23rd, less than a week after the police chokehold death of Eric Garner in Staten Island. Garner was also pinned to the ground while pleading, "I can't breathe." A grand jury declined to indict a white police officer, Daniel Pantaleo, for Garner's death. But on Tuesday, Officer Joel Edward, who is black, was arraigned on charges that could carry up to a year in jail. Cell phone video shows Edward and another officer pinning Jamil Cuffy to the ground while he pleads, "Help me." Edward briefly removed his gun before replacing it in the holster. He then walked away, returned to Cuffy, and